"Please, let's go," she said thickly to the driver, as Matthew came down the steps and bent to speak to her through the glass. "I still fucking love you." The car moved away over the cobbles of Albury Street, past the moulded frontages of the pretty sea merchants' houses, where she had never felt she belonged. At the top of the street she knew that if she looked back, she would see Matthew standing watching the vanishing car. Her eyes met those of the driver in the rear-view mirror. "Sorry," said Robin nonsensically, and then, bewildered by her own apology, she said, I've just left my husband." "Yeah?" said the driver, switching on her indicator. "I've left too. It gets easier with practice." Robin tried to laugh, but the noise turned into a loud, wet hiccup, and as the car approached the lonely stone swan high on the corner pub, she began to cry in earnest. "Here," said the driver gently, and she passed back a plastic wrap pack of tissues.
"Thanks,"
sobbed Robin, extracting one and pressing it to her tired, stinging eyes, until the white tissue was sodden and streaked with the last traces of thick black eye makeup that she had worn to impersonate Bobby Cunliffe. Avoiding the sympathetic gaze of the driver in the rearview mirror, she looked down into her lap. The wrapper on the tissues was that of an unfamiliar American brand, Dr. Blanc. At once, Robin's elusive memory dropped into view, as though it had been waiting for this tiny prod. Now she remembered exactly where she had seen the phrase, Blanc de Blanc. But it had nothing to do with the case, and everything to do with her imploding marriage, with a lavender walk and a Japanese water garden, and the last time she had ever said, "I love you," and the first time she'd known she didn't mean it. Chapter 56. I cannot, I will not, go through life with a dead body on my back. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. As Strike approached Henley's corner on the North Circular Road the following afternoon, he saw with a muttered oath that traffic ahead had come to a halt. The junction, which was a notorious hot spot for congestion, had supposedly been improved earlier that year. As he joined the stationary queue, Strike wound down his window, lit a cigarette, and glanced at his dashboard clock, with the familiar sensation of angry impotence that driving in London so often engendered. He had wondered whether it might be wiser to take the tube north, but the psychiatric hospital lay a good mile from the nearest station, and the BMW was marginally easier on his still sore leg. Now he feared that he was going to be late for an interview that he was determined not to miss. Firstly, because he had no wish to disoblige the psychiatric team who were letting him see Billy Knight. And secondly, because Strike didn't know when there would next be an opportunity to speak to the younger brother without fear of running into the older. Barclay had assured him that morning that Jimmy's plans for the day comprised writing a polemic on Rothschild's global influence for the Real Socialist website and sampling some of Barclay's new stash. Scowling and tapping his fingers on the steering wheel, Strike fell back to ruminating on a question that had been nagging at him since the previous evening. Whether or not the cut connection halfway through his call to Robin had really been due to Matthew snatching the phone out of her hand. He had not found Robin's subsequent assurances that all was well particularly convincing. While heating himself baked beans on his one-ringed hob, because he was still attempting to lose weight, Strike had debated calling Robin back. Eating his meatless dinner unenthusiastically in front of the television, supposedly watching highlights of the Olympics closing ceremony, his attention was barely held by the sight of the Spice Girls zooming around on top of London cabs. "I think marriage is nearly always an unfathomable entity, even to the people inside it," Della Wynne had said. Perhaps Robin and Matthew were even now in bed together. Was pulling a phone out of her hand any worse than deleting her call history? She had stayed with Matthew after that. Where was her red line? and Matthew was surely too careful of his own reputation and prospects to abandon all civilized norms. One of Strike's last thoughts before falling asleep the night before had been that Robin had successfully fought off the Shacklewell Ripper, a grisly reflection perhaps, but one that brought a certain reassurance. The detective was perfectly aware that the state of his junior partner's marriage ought to be the least of his worries, given that he so far had no concrete information for the client who was currently paying 3 full-time investigators to find out the facts about her father's death. Nevertheless, as the traffic finally moved on, Strike's thoughts continued to eddy around Robin and Matthew until at last he saw a signpost at the psychiatric clinic and with an effort focused his mind on the forthcoming interview. Unlike the gigantic rectangular prism of concrete and black glass where Jack had been admitted a few weeks earlier, the hospital outside which Strike parked 20 minutes later boasted crocketed spires and Byzantine windows covered with iron bars. In Strike's opinion, it looked like the bastard offspring of a gingerbread palace and a Gothic prison. A Victorian stonemason had carved the word sanatorium into the dirty red brick arch over the double doorway. Already 5 minutes late, Strike flung open the driver's door and, not bothering to change his trainers for smarter footwear, locked the BMW and hurried, limping, up the grubby front steps. Inside he found a chilly hallway with high off-white ceilings, church-like windows, and a general suspicion of decay, barely kept at bay by the fug of disinfectant. Spotting the ward number he had been given by phone, he set off along a corridor to the left. Sunlight falling through the barred windows cast stripe patches onto the off-white walls, which were hung crookedly with art, some of which had been done by former patients. As Strike passed a series of collages depicting detailed farmyard scenes in felt, tinsel and yarn, a skeletal teenage girl emerged from a bathroom alongside a nurse. Neither of them seemed to notice Strike. Indeed, the girl's dull eyes were focused, it seemed to him, inward upon a battle she was waging far from the real world. Strike was faintly surprised to discover the double doors to the locked ward at the end of the ground floor corridor. Some vague association with belfries and Rochester's first wife had led him to picture it on an upper floor, hidden perhaps in one of those pointed spires. The reality was entirely prosaic. A large green buzzer on the wall, which Strike pressed, and a male nurse with bright red hair peering through a small glass window, who turned to speak to somebody behind him. The door opened, and Strike was admitted. The ward had 4 beds in a seating area, where 2 patients in day clothes were sitting, playing draughts. An older, apparently toothless man and a pale youth with a thickly bandaged neck. A cluster of people were standing around a workstation just inside the door, an orderly, 2 more nurses, and what Strike assumed to be 2 doctors. One male, 1 female. All turned to stare at him as he entered. One of the nurses nudged the other. "Mr. Strike," said the male doctor, who was short, rather foxy in appearance, and had a strong Mancunian accent. "How do you do? Colin Hepworth, we spoke on the phone. This is my colleague, Camilla Mohammed." Strike shook hands with a woman whose navy trouser suit reminded him of a policewoman's. "We're both going to be sitting in on your interview with Billy," she said. "He's just gone to the bathroom. He's quite excited about seeing you again. We thought we'd use one of our interview rooms. It's right here." She led him around the workstation, the nurses still watching avidly, into a small room containing 4 chairs and a desk that had been bolted to the floor. The walls were pale pink, but otherwise bare. "Ideal," said Strike. It was like 100 interview rooms he had used in the military police. There, too, third parties had often been present, usually lawyers. "A quick word before we start," said Camilla Mohammed, pulling the door to on Strike and her colleague so that the nurses couldn't hear their conversation. "I don't know how much you know about Billy's condition, His brother told me it's schizoid affective disorder.
That's right, she said. He went off his medication and ended up in a full-blown psychotic episode, which by the sounds of it is when he came to see you.
Yeah, he seemed pretty disturbed at the time. He looked as though he'd been sleeping rough as well.
He probably had been. His brother told us he'd been missing around a week at that point. We don't believe Billy's psychotic any more, she said. But he's still quite closed down, so it's hard to gauge to what degree he's engaged with reality. It can be difficult to get an accurate picture of someone's mental state where there are paranoid and delusional symptoms.
We're hoping that ye can help us disentangle some of the facts from the fiction, said the Mancunian. You've been a recurring motif in his conversation ever since he was sectioned. He's been very keen to talk to you, but not so much to any of us. He's also expressed fear of repercussions if he confides in anyone, and again, it's difficult to know whether that fear is part of his illness or, whether there's someone who he genuinely has reason to fear. Because, he hesitated, as though trying to choose his words carefully. Strike said, I'd imagine his brother could be scary if he chose to be. And the psychiatrist seemed relieved to have been understood without breaking confidentiality. You know his brother, do you?
I've met him.
Does he visit often?
He's been a couple of times, but Billy's often been more distressed and agitated after seeing him.
If he seems to be similarly affected during your interview, said the Mancunian.
Understood, said Strike.
Funny, really, seeing you here, said Colin with a faint grin. We assumed that his fixation with you was all part of his psychosis. An obsession with a celebrity is quite common with these kind of disorders.
As a matter of fact, he said candidly, just a couple of days ago Camilla and I were agreeing that his fixation with you would preclude an early discharge.
Look who you called, really.
Yeah, said Strike dryly. That is lucky.
The red-headed male nurse knocked on the door and put his head in.
That's Billy ready to talk to Mr. Strike.
Great, said the female psychiatrist. Eddie, could we get some tea in here?
Tea?
She asked Strike over her shoulder. He nodded. She opened the door.
Come in, Billy.
And there he was.
Billy Knight, wearing a grey sweatshirt and jogging pants, his feet in hospital slippers.
The sunken eyes were still deeply shadowed, and at some point since he and Strike had last seen each other, he had shaven his head. The finger and thumb of his left hand were bandaged. Even through the tracksuit that somebody, presumably Jimmy, had brought him to wear, Strike could tell that he was underweight. But while his fingernails were bitten to bloody stubs, and there was an angry sore at the corner of his mouth, there was no longer an animal stench about him. He shuffled inside the interview room, staring at Strike, then held out a bony hand, which Strike shook. Billy addressed the doctors.
Are you two going to stay?
Yes, said Colin. But don't worry, we're going to keep quiet. You can say whatever you like to Mr. Strike.
Camilla positioned two chairs against the wall, and Strike and Billy sat down opposite each other, the desk between them. Strike could have wished for a less formal configuration of furniture, but his experience in Special Investigation Branch had taught him that a solid barrier between questioner and interviewee was often useful, and doubtless this was just as true on a locked psychiatric ward.
"I've been trying to find you since you first came to see me," Strike said. "I've been quite worried about you."
"Yeah," said Billy. "Sorry."
"Can you remember what you said to me at the office?"
Absently, it seemed, Billy touched his nose and his sternum, but it was a ghost of the tic he had exhibited in Denmark Street, and almost as though he sought to remind himself how he had felt then.
"Yeah,"
he said, with a small, humourless smile.
"I told you about the kid up by the horse, the one I saw strangled."
"Do you still think you witnessed a child being strangled?"
asked Strike. Billy raised a forefinger to his mouth, gnawed at the nail and nodded.
Yeah, he said, removing the finger. I saw it. Jimmy says I imagined it because I'm, you know, ill. You know Jimmy, don't you? Went to the White Horse after him, didn't you?
Strike nodded.
He was fucking livid. White Horse, said Billy with a sudden laugh. That's funny. Shit, that's funny. I never even thought of that before.
You told me you saw a child killed up by the horse. Which horse did you mean?
White Horse of Uffington, said Billy. Big chalk figure up on a hill near where I grew up. Doesn't look like a horse. More like a dragon, and it's on Dragon Hill as well. I've never understood why they all say it's a horse.
Can you tell me exactly what you saw up there?
Like the skeletal girl Strike had just passed, he had the impression that Billy was staring inside himself, and that outer reality had temporarily ceased to exist for him. Finally, he said quietly,
I was a little kid, proper little. I think they'd given me something. I felt sick and ill, like I was dreaming, slow and groggy. And they kept trying to make me repeat words and stuff, and I couldn't speak properly, and they all thought it was funny. I fell over in the grass on the way up. One of them carried me for a bit. I wanted to sleep.
You think you'd been given drugs?
Yeah, said Billy dully. Hash, probably. Jimmy usually had some. I think Jimmy took me up the hill with them to keep my father from knowing what they'd done.
Who do you mean by they?
I don't know, said Billy simply. Grown-ups. Jimmy's 10 years older than me. Dad used to make him look after me all the time, if he was out with his drinking mates. This lot came to the house in the night and I woke up. One of them gave me a yogurt to eat. There was another little kid there, a girl. And then we all went out in a car. I didn't want to go, I felt sick. I was crying, but Jimmy belted me. And we went to the horse in the dark. Me and the little girl were the only kids. She was howling, said Billy, and the skin of his gaunt face seemed to shrink more tightly to his bones as he said it, screaming for her mum, and he said, Your mum can't hear you now, she's gone.
Who said that? Asked Strike.
Him, whispered Billy, the one that strangled her.
The door opened and a new nurse brought in tea.
Here we go, she said brightly, her eager eyes on Strike.
The male psychiatrist frowned at her slightly and she withdrew, closing the door again.
Nobody's ever believed me, said Billy, and Strike heard the underlying plea. I've tried to remember more. I wish I could. If I've got to think about it all the time, I wish I could remember more of it. He strangled her to stop her making a noise. I don't think he meant it to go that far. They all panicked. I could remember someone shouting, You've killed her! Or him, Billy said quietly. Jimmy said afterwards it was a boy, but he won't admit that now. Says I'm making it all up. Why would I say it was a boy when none of it ever fucking happened? You're mental. It was a girl, said Billy stubbornly. I don't know why he tried to say it wasn't. They called her a girl's name. I can't remember what it was, but it was a girl. I saw her fall, dead, limp on the ground. It was dark. And then they panicked. I can't remember anything about going back down the hill. Can't remember anything after that except the burial, down in the dell by my dad's place.
The same night? Asked Strike.
I think so. I think it was, said Billy nervously, because I remember looking out of my bedroom window, and it was still dark, and they were carrying it to the dell, my dad and him.
Who's him?
The one who killed her. I think it was him, big guy, white hair. And they put a bundle in the ground, all wrapped up in a pink blanket, and they closed it in.
Did you ask your father about what you'd seen?
No, said Billy. You didn't ask my dad questions about what he did for the family.
For which family?
Billy frowned in what seemed to be genuine puzzlement.
You mean for your family?
No, the family he worked for, the Chisels.
Strike had the impression that this was the first time the dead minister's family name had been mentioned in front of the two psychiatrists. He saw two pens falter.
How was the burial connected with them?
Billy seemed confused. He opened his mouth to say something, appeared to change his mind, frowned around the pale pink walls, and fell to gnawing his forefinger again. Finally he said,
I don't know why I said that.
It didn't feel like a lie or a denial. Billy seemed genuinely surprised by the words that had fallen out of his mouth.
You can't remember hearing anything or seeing anything that would make you think he was burying the child for the chisels.
No,
said Billy slowly, brow furrowed.
I thought then, when I said it, he was doing a favour for... Like I heard something, after...
He shook his head.
Ignore that. I don't know why I said it.
People's places and things, thought Strike, taking out his notebook and opening it.
Other than Jimmy and the little girl who died, said Strike, what can you remember about the group of people who went to the horse that night? How many of them would you say there were?
Billy thought hard.
I don't know. Maybe 8, 10 people?
All men?
No, there were women too.
Over Billy's shoulder, Strike saw the female psychiatrist raise her eyebrows.
Can you remember anything else about the group? I know you were young, Strike said, anticipating Billy's objection, and I know you might have been given something that disorientated you. But can you remember anything you haven't told me? Anything they did? Anything they were wearing? Can you remember anyone's hair or skin colour? Anything at all?
There was a long pause, then Billy closed his eyes briefly and shook his head once, as though disagreeing firmly with a suggestion only he could hear.
She was dark, the little girl, like...
By a tiny turn of his head, he indicated the female doctor behind him.
Asian, said Strike.
Maybe, said Billy. Yeah, black hair.
Who carried you up the hill?
Jimmy and one of the other men took turns.
Nobody talked about why they were going up there in the dark.
I think they wanted to get to the eye, said Billy.
The eye of the horse?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know, said Billy,
as he ran his hands nervously over his shaven head.
There are stories about the eye, you know.
He strangled her in the eye.
I know that. I can remember that all right. She pissed herself as she died. I saw it spattering on the white.
And you can't remember anything about the man who did it.
But Billy's face had crumbled. Hunched over, he heaved with dry sobs, shaking his head. The male doctor half rose from his seat. Billy seemed to sense the movement, because he steadied himself and shook his head.
I'm all right, he said. I want to tell him. I've got to know if it's real. All my life I can't stand it any more. I've got to know. Let him ask me. I know he's got to. Let him ask me, said Billy. I can take it.
The psychiatrist sat slowly back down.
Don't forget your tea, Billy.
Yeah, said Billy,
blinking away the tears in his eyes and wiping his nose on the back of his sleeve.
All right.
He took the mug between his bandaged hand and his good one and took a sip.
Okay to continue? Strike asked him.
Yeah,
said Billy quietly.
Go on.
Can you remember anyone ever mentioning a girl called Suki Lewis, Billy?
Strike had expected a no. He had already turned the page to the list of questions written under the heading Places when Billy said,
Yeah.
What? Said Strike.
The Butcher brothers knew her, said Billy. Mates of Jimmy's from home. They did a bit of work around the Chisels place sometimes with Dad. Bit of gardening and help with the horses.
They knew Suki Lewis.
Yeah. She ran away, didn't she? Said Billy. She was on the local news. The Butchers were excited because they seen her picture on the telly and they knew her family. Her mum was a head case. Yeah, she was in care and she ran away to Aberdeen.
Aberdeen?
Yeah, that's what the Butchers said.
She was 12.
She had family up there. They let her stay.
Is that right? Said Strike.
He wondered whether Aberdeen had seemed unfathomably remote to the teenage butchers of Oxfordshire, and whether they had been more inclined to believe this story because it was to them uncheckable and so, strangely, more believable.
We're talking about Tegan's brothers, right? Asked Strike.
You can see he's good,
Billy said naively over his shoulder to the male psychiatrist.
Can't you? See how much he knows.
Yeah,
he said, turning back to Strike.
She's their little sister. They were like us, working for the Chisels. There used to be a lot to do in the old days, but they sold off a lot of the land. They don't need so many people anymore.
He drank some more tea, the mug in both hands.
Billy, said Strike, do you know where you've been since you came to my office?
At once, the tick reappeared. Billy's right hand released the warm mug and touched his nose and chest in quick, nervous succession.
Jimmy doesn't want me to talk about that, he said,
setting the mug clumsily back on the desk.
He told me not to.
I think it's more important you answer Mr. Strike's questions than worry about what your brother thinks, said the male doctor from behind Strike.
You know, you don't have to see Jimmy if you don't want to, Billy. We can ask him to give you some time here, to get better in peace.
Did Jimmy visit you where you've been staying? Strike asked.
Billy chewed his lip.
Yeah, he said at last. And he said I had to stay there or I'd cock everything up for him again. I thought the door had explosives round it, he said with a nervy laugh. Thought if I tried to go out the door I'd explode. Probably not right, is it?
He said, appearing to search Strike's expression for a clue.
I get ideas about stuff sometimes when I'm bad.
Can you remember how you got away from the place you were being kept?
I thought they switched off the explosives, said Billy. The guy told me to run for it, and I did.
What guy was this?
The one who was in charge of keeping me there.
Can you remember anything you did while you were being kept captive? Strike asked. How you spent your time?
The other shook his head.
Can you remember, said Strike, carving anything into wood?
Billy's gaze was full of fear and wonder. Then he laughed.
You know it all, he said, and held up his bandaged left hand. Knife slipped, went right in me.
The male psychiatrist added helpfully, Billy had tetanus when he came in. There was a very nasty, infected gash on that hand.
What did you carve into the door, Billy?
I really did that then, did I? Carve the white horse on the door. Because afterwards, I didn't know if I really did that or not.
Yeah, you did it, said Strike. I've seen the door. It was a good carving.
Yeah, said Billy. Well, I used to do some of that carving for my dad.
What did you carve the horse onto?
Pendants, said Billy surprisingly. On little circles of wood with leather through 'em, for tourists. Sold 'em in a shop over in Wantage.
Billy, said Strike, can you remember how you ended up in that bathroom? Did you go there to see someone, or did somebody take you there?
Billy's eyes roamed around the pink walls again, a deep furrow between his eyes as he thought.
I was looking for a man called Winner. No.
Win? Geraint Win?
Yeah,
said Billy, again surveying Strike with astonishment.
You know everything. How do you know all this?
I've been looking for you, said Strike.
What made you want to find Win? I heard Jimmy talking about him, said Billy, gnawing at his nail again. Jimmy said Wynne was going to help find out all about the kid who was killed.
Wynne was going to help find out about the child who was strangled.
Yeah, said Billy nervously. See, I thought you were one of the people trying to catch me and lock me up after I saw you. Thought you were trying to trap me and... I get like that when I'm bad, he said hopelessly. So I went to Wynne, instead. Jimmy had a phone number and address for him written down, so I went to find Wynne, and then I got caught.
Caught?
By the brown-skinned bloke, mumbled Billy, with a half-glance back at the female psychiatrist. I was scared of him. I thought he was a terrorist and he was going to kill me. But then he told me he was working for the government, so I thought the government wanted to keep me there in his house, and the doors and windows were wired with explosives. But I don't think they were, really. That was just me. He probably didn't want me in his bathroom. Probably wanted to get rid of me all along, said Billy with a sad smile. And I wouldn't go, because I thought I'd get blown up. His right hand crept absently back to his nose and chest. I think I tried to call you again, but you didn't answer.
You did call. You left a message on my answering machine.
Did I? Yeah. I thought you'd help me get out of there. Sorry, said Billy, rubbing his eyes. When I'm like that, I don't know what I'm doing.
But you're sure you saw a child strangled, Billy? Asked Strike quietly.
Oh, yeah, said Billy bleakly, raising his face. Yeah, that never goes away. I know I saw it.
Did you ever try and dig where you thought?
Christ, no, said Billy. Go digging right by my dad's house? No. I was scared, he said weakly. I didn't want to see it again. After they buried her, they let it grow over, nettles and weeds. I used to have dreams like you wouldn't believe. That she climbed up out of the dell in the dark, all rotting, and tried to climb in my bedroom window.
The psychiatrist's pens moved scratchily across their papers. Strike moved down to the category of things that he had written on his notebook. There were only two questions left. Did you ever put a cross in the ground where you saw the body buried, Billy?
No, said Billy, scared at the very idea. I never went near the dell if I could avoid it. I never wanted to.
Last question, Strike said. Billy, did your father do anything unusual for the Chisels? I know he was a handyman, but can you think of anything else he...
What do you mean? Said Billy.
He seemed suddenly more frightened than he had seemed all interview.
I don't know, said Strike carefully, watching his reaction. I just wondered...
Jimmy warned me about this. He told me you were snooping around, Dad. You can't blame us for that. We had nothing to do with it. We were kids.
I'm not blaming you for anything, said Strike.
But there was a clatter of chairs. Billy and the two psychiatrists had got to their feet, the female's hand hovering over a discreet button beside the door that Strike knew must be an alarm.
Has this all been to get me to talk? You trying to get me and Jimmy in trouble?
No, said Strike, hoisting himself to his feet too. I'm here because I believe you saw a child strangled, Billy.
Agitated, mistrustful, Billy's unbandaged hand touched his nose and chest twice in quick succession.
So why are you asking what Dad did? He whispered. That's not how she died. It was nothing to do with that. Jimmy will fucking tan me, he said in a broken voice. He told me you were after him for what Dad did.
Nobody's going to tan anyone, said the male psychiatrist firmly.
Time's up, I think, he said briskly to Strike, pushing open the door. Go on, Billy. Out you go. But Billy didn't move. The skin and bone might have aged, but his face betrayed the fear and hopelessness of a small motherless child whose sanity had been broken by the men who were supposed to protect him. Strike, who had met countless rootless and neglected children during his rackety, unstable childhood, recognized in Billy's imploring expression a last plea to the adult world to do what grown-ups were meant to do and impose order on chaos, substitute sanity for brutality. Face to face, he felt a strange kinship with the emaciated, shaven-headed psychiatric patient, because he recognized the same craving for order in himself. In his case, it had led him to the official side of the desk, but perhaps the only difference between the two of them was that Strike's mother had lived long enough and loved him well enough to stop him breaking when life threw terrible things at him. I'm going to find out what happened to the kid you saw strangled, Billy. That's a promise. The psychiatrists looked surprised, even disapproving. It was not part of their profession, Strike knew, to make definitive statements or guarantee resolutions. He put his notebook back into his pocket, moved from behind the desk and held out his hand. After a few long moments' consideration, the animosity seemed to seep out of Billy. He shuffled back to Strike, took his proffered hand, and held it over Long, his eyes filling with tears. In a whisper, so that neither of the doctors could hear, he said,
"I hated putting the horse on him, Mr. Strike. I hated it."
Chapter 57. Have you the courage and the strength of will for that, Rebecca? Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Vanessa's one-bedroom flat occupied the ground floor of a detached house a short distance from Wembley Stadium. Before leaving for work that morning, she had given Robin a spare key to her flat, along with a kindly assurance that she knew that it would take Robin longer than a couple of days to find a new place to live, and that she didn't mind her staying until she managed to do so. They had sat up late drinking the night before. Vanessa had told Robin the full story of finding out that her ex-fiancé had cheated on her, a story full of twists and counter-twists that Vanessa had never told before, which included the setting up of two fake Facebook pages as bait for both her ex and his lover, which had resulted, after 3 months of patient coaxing, in Vanessa receiving nude pictures from both of them. As impressed as she was shocked, Robin had laughed as Vanessa reenacted the scene in which she passed her ex the pictures hidden inside a Valentine card she had handed across a table for two in their favourite restaurant. "You're too nice, girl," said Vanessa, steely-eyed over her Pinot Grigio. "At a bare minimum, I'd have kept her bleeding earring and turned it into a pendant." Vanessa was now at work. A spare duvet sat neatly folded at the end of the sofa on which Robin was sitting, with her laptop open in front of her. She had spent the entire afternoon scanning available rooms in shared properties, which were all she could possibly afford on the salary that Strike was paying her. The memory of the bunk bed in Flick's flat kept recurring as she scanned the adverts in her price range, some of which featured stark, barrack-like rooms with multiple beds inside them, others with photographs that looked as though they ought to feature attached to news stories about reclusive hoarders discovered dead by neighbours. Last night's laughter seemed remote now. Robin was ignoring the painful hard lump in her throat that refused to dissolve, no matter how many cups of tea she consumed. Matthew had tried to contact her twice that day. Neither time had she picked up, and he hadn't left a message. She would need to contact a lawyer about divorce soon, and that would cost money she didn't have. But her first priority had to be finding herself a place to live and continuing to put in the usual number of hours on the chisel case. Because if Strike had cause to feel she wasn't pulling her weight, she would be endangering the only part of her life that currently had worth. "You bailed out on uni. Now you're bailing out on us. You even bailed on your therapist. You're a fucking flake." The photographs of grim rooms in unknown flats kept dissolving before her eyes, as she pictured Matthew and Sarah in the heavy mahogany bed that her father-in-law had bought. And when this happened, Robin's insides seemed to turn to liquid lead, and her self-control threatened to melt away, and she wanted to phone Matthew back and scream at him. But she didn't, because she refused to be what he wanted to make her, the irrational, incontinent, uncontrolled woman. The fucking flake. And anyway, she had news for Strike, news she was keen to impart once he had finished his interview with Billy. Raphael Chisel had answered his mobile at 11 o'clock that morning, and after some initial coldness, had agreed to talk to her, but only at a place of his choosing. An hour later, she had received a call from Tegan Butcher, who had not required much persuasion to agree to an interview. Indeed, she seemed disappointed to be talking to the famous Strike's partner, rather than the man himself. Robin copied down the details of a room in Putney. Live-in landlady, vegetarian household, must like cats. Checked the time, and decided to change into the only dress she had brought with her from Albury Street, which was hanging, ironed and ready, from the top of Vanessa's kitchen door. It would take her over an hour to get from Wembley to the restaurant in Old Brompton Road, where she and Raphael had agreed to meet, and she feared that she needed more time than usual to make herself presentable. The face staring out of Vanessa's bathroom mirror was white, with eyes still puffy with lack of sleep. Robin was still trying to paint out the shadows with concealer when her mobile rang.
"Cormoran, hi," said Robin, switching to speakerphone.
"Did you see Billy?" His account of the interview with Billy took 10 minutes, during which time Robin finished her makeup, brushed her hair, and pulled on the dress.
"You know," Strike finished, "I'm starting to wonder whether we shouldn't do what Billy wanted us to do in the first place. Dig."
"Hmm," said Robin, and then,
"Wait, what? You mean, literally?"
"It might come to that," said Strike.
For the first time all day, Robin's own troubles were entirely eclipsed by something else, something monstrous. Jasper Chisels had been the first body she had seen outside the comforting, sanitized context of a hospital and the funeral parlour. Even the memory of the shrink-wrapped turnip head, with its dark, gasping cavity for a mouth, paled beside the prospect of earth and worms, a decaying blanket, and a child's rotting bones.
"Cormoran, if you think there's genuinely a child buried in the dell, we should be telling the police."
"I might if I thought Billy's psychiatrists would vouch for him, but they won't. I had a long talk with them after the interview. They can't say 100% that the child strangling didn't happen. The old impossible to prove a negative problem. But they don't believe it."
"They think he's making it up?"
"Not in the normal sense. They think it's a delusion, or at best, that he misinterpreted something he saw when he was very young. Maybe even something on TV. It would be consistent with his overall symptoms. I think myself there's unlikely to be anything down there, but it would be good to know for sure. Anyway, how's your day been? Any news?"
"What?"
Robin repeated numbly.
"Oh, yes. I'm meeting Raphael for a drink at 7 o'clock.
"Excellent work," said Strike. "Where?"
"Place called Nam something. Nam Long Le Shaker."
"The place in Chelsea," said Strike. "I was there a long time ago. Not the best evening I've ever had."
"And Tegan Butcher rang back. She's a bit of a fan of yours by the sound of it."
"Just what this case needs, another mentally disturbed witness."
"Tasteless," said Robin,
trying to sound amused.
"Anyway, she's living with her mum in Woolston and working at a bar at Newbury Racecourse. She says she doesn't want to meet us in the village because her mum won't like her getting mixed up with us, so she wonders whether we could come and see her at Newbury."
"How far is that from Woolston?"
20 miles or so."
"All right," said Strike. "How about we take the Land Rover out to Newbury to interview Tegan and then maybe swing by the Dell, just for another look?"
Yes, okay," said Robin,
her mind racing over the logistics of having to return to Albury Street for the Land Rover. She had left it behind because parking places required a permit on Vanessa Street.
"When?"
"Whenever Tegan can see us, but ideally this week. Sooner the better."
"Okay,"
said Robin, thinking of the tentative plans she had made to view rooms over the next couple of days.
"Everything all right, Robin?"
"Yes, of course."
"Ring me when you've spoken to Raphael, then, okay?"
"Will do,"
said Robin, glad to end the call.
"Speak later."
Chapter 58. I believe two different kinds of will can exist at the same time in one person. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Nam Long Le Shaker had the feeling of a decadent colonial-era bar, dimly lit, with leafy plants and assorted paintings, and prints of beautiful woman, the decor mixed Vietnamese and European styles. When Robin entered the restaurant at 7:05, she found Raphael leaning up against the bar, wearing a dark suit and tieless white shirt, already halfway down a drink, and talking to the long-haired beauty who stood in front of a glittering wall of bottles.
"Hi," said Robin.
"Hello," he responded with a trace of coolness, and then, "Your eyes are different. Were that colour at Chisel House?"
"Blue?"
asked Robin, shrugging off the coat she had worn because she felt shivery, even though the evening was warm.
"Yes."
"Suppose I didn't notice because half the bloody light bulbs are missing.
What are you drinking?"
Robin hesitated. She ought not to drink while conducting an interview, but at the same time, she suddenly craved alcohol. Before she could decide, Raphael said with a slight edge in his voice, "Been undercover again today, have we?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Your wedding ring's gone again." "Were your eyes this sharp in the office?" asked Robin, and he grinned, reminding her why she had liked him, even against her will. "I noticed your glasses were fake, remember?" he said. "I thought at the time you were trying to be taken seriously because you were too pretty for politics. So these," he indicated his deep brown eyes, "may be sharp, but this," he tapped his head, "not so much."
"I'll have a glass of red," said Robin, smiling. "And I'll pay, obviously."
"If this is all on Mr. Strike, let's have dinner," said Raphael at once. "I'm starving and skint."
"Really?"
After a day of trawling through the available rooms for rent on her agency salary, she was not in the mood to hear the Chisel definition of poverty again.
"Yeah, really. Little though you might believe it," said Raphael, with a slightly acid smile, and Robin suspected he knew what she had been thinking. "Seriously, are we eating or what?"
"Fine," said Robin, who had barely touched food all day. "Let's eat." Raphael took his bottle of beer off the bar and led her through to the restaurant, where they took a table for two beside the wall. It was so early that they were the only diners.
"My mother used to come here in the '80s, said Raphael. "It was well known because the owner liked telling the rich and famous to sod off if they weren't dressed properly to come in, and they all loved it."
"Really?" said Robin, her thoughts miles away. It had just struck her that she would never again have dinner with Matthew like this, just the two of them. She remembered the very last time, at Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons. What had he been thinking while he ate in silence? Certainly he had been furious at her for continuing to work with Strike, but perhaps he had also been weighing in his mind the competing attractions of Sarah, with her well-paid job at Christie's, her endless fund of stories about other people's wealth, and her no doubt self-confident performance in bed, where the diamond earrings her fiancé had bought her snagged on Robin's pillow.
"Listen, if eating with me is going to make you look like that, I'm fine with going back to the bar," said Raphael.
"What?" said Robin, surprised out of her thoughts.
"Oh, no, it isn't you."
A waiter brought over Robin's wine. She took a large slug.
"Sorry," she said. "I was just thinking about my husband. I left him last night."
As she watched Raphael freeze in surprise with the bottle at his lips, Robin knew herself to have crossed an invisible boundary. In her whole time at the agency, she had never used truths about her private life to gain another's confidence, never blended the private and the professional to win another person over. In turning Matthew's infidelity into a device to manipulate Raphael, she knew that she was doing something that would appall and disgust her husband. Their marriage, he would have thought, ought to be sacrosanct, a world apart from what he saw as her seedy, ramshackle job.
"Seriously?" said Raphael.
"Yes," said Robin. "But I don't expect you to believe me. Not after all the crap I told you when I was Venetia. Anyway," she took her notebook out of her handbag,
"you said you were okay with me asking some questions."
Yeah, he said, apparently unable to decide whether he was more amused or disconcerted.
"Is this real? Your marriage broke up last night."
"Yes," said Robin.
"Why are you looking so shocked?"
"I don't know,"
said Raphael. You just seem so girl-guidy. His eyes moved over her face. It's part of the appeal.
Could I just ask my questions? Said Robin, determinedly unfazed.
Raphael drank some beer and said, Always busy with the job. Turns a man's thoughts to what it would take to distract you.
Seriously, fine, questions. But let's order first. Fancy some dim sum?
Whatever's good, said Robin, opening her notebook. Ordering food seemed to cheer Raphael up.
Drink up, he said.
I shouldn't be drinking at all, she replied. And indeed, she hadn't touched the wine since her first gulp.
Okay. I wanted to talk about Ebury Street.
Go on, said Raphael.
You heard what Kinvara said about the keys. I wondered whether...
I ever had one, asked Raphael with equanimity.
Guess how many times I was ever in that house.
Robin waited.
Once, said Raphael. Never went there as a kid. When I got out of, you know, Dad, who hadn't visited me once while I was inside, invited me down to Chisel House to see him, so I did. Brushed my hair, put on a suit, got all the way down to that hellhole, and he didn't bother turning up. Detained by a late boat at the house or some crap. Picture how happy Kinvara was to have me on her hands for the night, in that bloody depressing house that I've had bad dreams about ever since I was a kid. Welcome home, Raph. I took the early train back to London. Following week, no contact from Dad until I get another summons. This time to go to Ebury Street. I considered just not bloody turning up. Why did I go?
I don't know, said Robin.
Why did you?
He looked directly into her eyes.
You can bloody hate someone and still wish they gave a shit about you and hate yourself for wishing it.
Yes, said Robin quietly. Of course you can.
So round I trot to Ebury Street, thinking I might get a... not a heart-to-heart, I mean, you met my father. But maybe, you know, some human emotion. He opened the door and said, There you are. Shunted me into the sitting room, and there was Henry Drummond, and I realized I was there for a job interview. Drummond said he'd take me on. Dad barked at me not to fuck it up and shove me back out onto the street. First and last time I was ever inside the place, said Raphael. So I can't say I've got fond associations with it. He paused to consider what he'd just said, then let out a short laugh. And my father killed himself there, of course. I was forgetting that.
No key, said Robin, making a note.
No. Among the many things I didn't get that day were a spare key and an invitation to let myself in whenever I fancied it.
I need to ask you something that might seem as though it's slightly out of left field, said Robin cautiously.
This sounds interesting, said Raphael, leaning forwards.
Did you ever suspect that your father was having an affair?
What?
He said, almost comically taken aback.
No, but what?
Over the last year or so, said Robin, while he was married to Kinvara. He seemed incredulous.
Okay, said Robin. If you don't, what on earth makes you think he was having an affair?
Kinvara was always very possessive, very concerned about your father's whereabouts, wasn't she?
Yeah, said Raphael, now smirking. But you know why that was?
That was you. I heard that she broke down months before I went to work in the office. She told somebody that your father had cheated on her. She was distraught by all accounts. It was around the time her mare was put down and she hit Dad with a hammer.
He frowned.
Oh, I thought that was because of her not wanting the horse put down.
Well, I suppose Dad was a ladies' man when he was younger. Hey, maybe that's what he was up to the night I went down to Chisel House and he stayed up in London. Kinvara was definitely expecting him back, and she was furious when he cried off at the last minute.
Yes, maybe, said Robin, making a note. Can you remember what date that was?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I can.
You don't tend to forget the day you're released from jail. I got out on Wednesday the 16th of February last year, and Dad asked me to go down to Chisel House on the following Saturday, so the 19th. Robin made a note. You never saw or heard signs there was another woman?
Come on, said Raphael.
You were there, at the Commons. You saw how little I had to do with him. Was he going to tell me he was playing around?
He told you about seeing the ghost of Jacka Kent roaming the grounds at night.
That was different. He was drunk then, and morbid. Weird. Banging on about divine retribution. I don't know. I suppose he could have been talking about an affair. Maybe he'd grown a conscience at last, three wives down the line.
I didn't think he married your mother.
Raphael's eyes narrowed. Sorry. Momentarily forgot I'm the bastard.
Oh, come on, said Robin gently. You know I didn't mean.
All right, sorry, he muttered. Being touchy. Being left out of a parent's will does that to a person. Robin remembered Strike's dictum about inheritance. It is the money, and it isn't. And, in an uncanny echo of her thoughts, Raphael said, It isn't the money, although God knows I could use the money. I'm jobless, and I don't think old Henry Drummond's going to give me a reference, do you? And now my mother looks like she's going to settle permanently in Italy, so she's talking about selling the London flat, which means I'll be homeless.
It'll come to this, you know, he said bitterly. I'll end up as Kinvara's bloody stable boy. No one else will work for her, and no one else will employ me.
But it's not just the money. When you're left out of the will, well, left out, that says it all. The last statement of a dead man to his family, and I didn't rate a single mention, and now I've got fucking Torquil advising me to piss off to Siena with my mother and start again. Tosser, said Raphael, with a dangerous expression.
Is that where your mother lives, Siena?
Yeah, she's shacked up with an Italian count these days, and believe me, the last thing he wants is her 29-year-old son moving in. He's showing no sign of wanting to marry her, and she's starting to worry about her old age, hence the idea of flogging the flat here. She's getting a bit long in the tooth to pull the trick she did on my father.
What do you... She got pregnant on purpose.
Don't look so shocked. My mother doesn't believe in shielding me from the realities of life. She told me the story years ago. I'm a gamble that didn't come off. She thought he'd marry her if she got pregnant. But as you've just pointed out...
I said I'm sorry, said Robin. I am. It was really insensitive and stupid.
She thought perhaps Raphael was about to tell her to go to hell... But instead he said quietly,
See, you are sweet. You weren't entirely acting, were you, in the office?
I don't know, said Robin.
I suppose not.
Feeling his legs shift under the table, she moved very slightly backwards again.
What's your husband like? Raphael asked.
I don't know how to describe him.
Does he work for Christie's?
No. Said Robin. He's an accountant.
Christ! Said Raphael, appalled. Is that what you like?
He wasn't an accountant when I met him. Can we go back over your father calling you on the morning he died?
If you like, said Raphael, but I'd much rather talk about you.
Well, why don't you tell me what happened that morning, and then you can ask me whatever you like, said Robin. A fleeting smile passed over Raphael's face. He took a swig of beer and said,
Dad called me, told me he thought Kinvara was about to do something stupid, and told me to go straight down to Woolston and stop it. I did ask why it had to be me, you know.
You didn't tell us that at Chisel House, said Robin, looking up from her notes.
Of course I didn't, because the others were there. Dad said he didn't want to ask Izzy. He was quite rude about her on the phone. He was an ungrateful shit, really he was, said Raphael.
She worked her fingers to the bloody bone, and you saw how he treated her.
What do you mean, rude?
He said she'd shout at Kinvara, upset her, and make it worse or something. Pot and bloody kettle, but there you are.
But the truth is, said Raphael,
that he saw me as a kind of upper servant, and Izzy as proper family.